I call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 12th, 2026. A quorum is present. Representative Baker, would you like to move the minutes from March 10th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of March 10th.
Rep. Baker moves the March 10 minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3830. Representative Sexton, would you like to move your bill?
Chair Swazinski, yes, I wish to move House File 3830, cost reporting for recoverable rate case expenses and elimination of the sunset on the gas utility infrastructure cost rider provision in front of the committee for re-referral to the General Register.
Representative Sexton moves House File 3830 to put it before the committee. Representative Sexton, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. So good afternoon, Co-Chair Swazinski, Co-Chair Akam, all the members of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee and our outstanding staff. I am very proud to introduce House File 3830 and brag a little bit about the construction industry that welcomed me when I retired from the military and was looking for a new career field. The most important lessons I learned from this industry is there's three really important things: safety, safety, and safety. House File 3830 addresses safety in two different ways. As we can see in the text of the bill, the public utilities are asking us to eliminate a standing security vulnerability endangering their personnel by revealing the vendors they frequent, such as hotels and restaurants, in their receipts, which once they turn that information in, we have no idea who sees it and where it goes. We would consider this information sensitive, much like we consider the leases that we have in our apartments up here at the Capitol, some of the vendors and restaurants we go to, so I can see exactly the point they're trying to make. Today, we have the opportunity to increase safety and reduce the possibility of releasing sensitive information by passing this bill. Furthermore, I will note that this legislation does not reduce the ability of the PUC to provide oversight for expense reporting. Finally, I believe we can all relate to the need for safety and security of our personal information. Part two of this bill really appears as the rider. It would repeal a portion of a rider that's been on the books in various forms for a number of years. First, it showed up with the original enactment in 2005 with a sunset date of June 30, 2015. So that was the first 10 years. Then it was modified in 2013 with a sunset date of 2023. In 2023, it was modified again with a sunset date of June 30, 2028. It's been over 20 years that we've been doing this. It's time to make it permanent. So I'm going to abbreviate. The GUIC rider is a very successful model for ensuring pipeline and facilities integrity within the natural gas industry. I know we have some very experienced testifiers coming up for you very shortly, but please allow me to simplify GUIC with a small analogy. GUIC is about maintaining the utility infrastructure we already have. It is not about building new pipelines. That's a whole separate process that goes through PUC, permission, routing, and everything else. This is about making sure that, again, safety, safety, safety of all of us and the general public by maintaining the systems we already have in place. In comparison, I'm sure you've noticed a couple potholes driving around the roads here. This is a maintenance program much like we expect the City of St. Paul and the Minnesota Department of Transportation to maintain the roads. This is a highway for gas underground. We want to make sure that we're doing it safely. We maintain that pipeline for the safety of the public and everybody else working around these pipelines. If by chance we change and just allow this to sunset, we can anticipate delays in approving future work, which may end up piling up work, much like we see with HEPR and our colleges with many maintenance issues. So overall, I'm going to encourage that we pass this bill out of committee today because I think it really ensures the safety of the general public and makes sure that we have a robust maintenance program for all these natural gas pipelines. And with that, I would like to invite Mr. Ray Gardner, who joined me up front here for his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. If you'd like to come to the testifier's table, introduce yourself for the committee, and we're here to hear your testimony. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chair. My name is Ray Gardner. I'm the Area Vice President of Gas Engineering at Xcel Energy. By schooling, I have a mechanical engineering degree from the Colorado School of Mines, and I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Colorado. In my role at Xcel Energy, I have oversight of Xcel Energy's engineering, system design, integrity management, asset management, and capital project execution in each state in which Xcel Energy operates a gas system. Xcel Energy's gas system in Minnesota serves approximately 500,000 residential customers who rely on it every day for uses such as home heating, hot showers, and cooking. In addition to residential customers, our gas system supports commercial and industrial customers, as well as generation of electricity. The GUIC rider refers to the gas utility infrastructure cost rider utilized by Xcel Energy to recover costs for prudent mandates, safety, and compliance work on the system. This rider is about maintaining existing infrastructure and does not include projects that increase throughput or expand the system, which we typically refer to as capacity expansion and new business work. Capacity expansion and new business projects are recovered through traditional rate case recovery processes. The GUIC filing is very specific. It's focused on mandated relocations and federal code-required safety and compliance work on the existing gas system. This work includes projects such as maximum allowable operating pressure reconfirmation that are driven by federal regulations stemming from the PG&E San Bruno pipeline rupture, as well as pipeline assessment and repair and replacement work that is driven by federal integrity management regulations. These regulations stipulate not just the work that we do, as well as the timeframes at which we do them. The GUIC filings are very structured. Filings occur in November of each year and include a forward-looking view of planned expenditures for the upcoming year, an update on current year projects, and a true-up of the prior year. The rider provides additional oversight as compared to a rate case by nature of the three-year filing, as well as the risk assessment and performance metrics that were established in collaboration with stakeholders such as the Department of Commerce and the Office of Attorney General. Over the last several years, expenditures through the GUIC have maintained relatively flat, with some year-over-year variability driven by work scheduling and mandated relocation work required by municipalities. Historically, these filings had significant engagement by intervening parties while risk assessment and performance metrics were being developed. However, the last couple of years, there's been no opposition from parties. In closing, I want to emphasize that as operators of gas distribution and gas transmission infrastructure within the state of Minnesota, we take safety very seriously. We need to ensure the safety of the gas system today, regardless of how long we believe it will be in service. In fact, decoupling the safety of the existing system from new business and capacity expansion work enables Xcel Energy to focus efforts on advancing the state's climate policy goals while continuing to maintain the safety of the existing gas system. The GUIC is about maintaining the safety of the gas system we have today, not expanding it. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Gardner at all? All right, seeing none. Next on the list, we have Jamie Fitzke, if you'd want to come before the committee here. Introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jamie Fitzke. I'm Director of Government Affairs for CenterPoint Energy. So today is Thursday, and Thursdays are usually when the Public Utilities Commission has hearings, which means today you're all stuck with me as some of my colleagues who are more knowledgeable on GUIC are there, so my apologies. But I think there's a silver lining to that, which is I'm not a GUIC expert. But that's also because CenterPoint has never used the GUIC rider. So now you're really probably wondering, why am I here testifying in support of the GUIC? Well, first, the scope for these projects that qualify for the GUIC are extremely narrow. Integrity management projects that are mandated by federal, state, or local jurisdictions on existing infrastructure. This would be the same for an electric or water utility that was also required to be moved, or there was changes going on around it. GUIC projects undergo PUC and regulatory party scrutiny, similar to other riders that have extensive and thorough regulatory processes. For example of that would be like NGIA plans, the Natural Gas Innovation Act. To be clear, these lines are not new extensions, but required replacements of or upgrades to existing infrastructure. Minnesota has over 200 gas and electric utilities. No two utilities are the same. Utilities vary in size, customer composition, and unique local needs throughout the state. This is why I'm testifying in support of House File 3830. GUIC is an option that should remain available due to its narrow parameters to address safety and integrity program costs. It recognizes specific costs utilities are required to spend, and these costs are thoroughly reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission. The GUIC may allow a utility to recover such costs outside of a fully litigated rate case that can be resource intensive. We may be interested in that option one day. Historically, the GUIC has not been controversial. My other goal today is to learn more from the other testifiers, to hear their concerns and rationales, and for all of us to continue this conversation on GUIC and hopefully find a resolution that keeps this option available. Thank you for your time. That concludes my testimony.
Are there any questions for the testifier? All right, thank you. All right, we have Annie Levinson-Falk. If you want to come up, introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Chair Swedzinski, excuse me, Chair Akam and members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. And I want to first thank Representative Sexton for a good conversation about this bill and the next bill yesterday. So I really appreciate spending the time with us, and
absolutely,
we can understand each other's thought processes of this, on this bill a little bit better. I do have some concerns that I want to share with the committee. First, on Section 1, which is the portion that would no longer require utilities to report the vendor name of their expenses, I very much understand where the utilities are coming from with the safety concerns on that, and have been talking with Xcel, and I think we found a middle ground where they could continue to report the vendor name but have that redacted from public view. So I'm glad to be able to, I think, work that out with them and find a reasonable compromise. On Section 2 related to the GUIC rider, so please forgive me because this is going to get kind of procedural and in the weeds, but it's actually really important in determining who pays for what and who bears the risks related to the gas business. This is an example of what's commonly known as, like I said, a rider or a cost tracker. Utility costs are generally reviewed and approved to be charged to ratepayers under a rate case, and that's how rate making has worked for probably a century. It allows careful review, is the most thorough proceeding for rate recovery, and it gives the commission and the public and any interveners the fullest picture of the total costs that are being charged to ratepayers and how that's going to impact Minnesotans. On the utility side, it gives them a budget that they know that they have to work within. Until they choose to file their next rate case. So it gives them clarity on how much they have to spend. That's predictability, and it also has then some motivation to save money, because if they can come in under that budget, there's some savings for them. A tracker like GUIC allows for faster recovery and trues up their costs to actual. So if costs are lower than projected, ratepayers do have some savings, but if costs are higher than projected, the utility gets to charge the overage to ratepayers in that case. According to a 2010 report by the PUC that looked at these kinds of trackers and what they're best used for, a tracker like that should only be used in quote-unquote extraordinary circumstances, when costs are, quote, outside the control of the utility and unpredictable, or the utility would suffer, quote, severe financial consequences without it. None of those criteria apply in this case. The kinds of pipe replacements that GUIC is used for are the very core business of a gas company, and rate cases exist exactly for these types of costs. In that same PUC report that I just mentioned, it also says that cost trackers, quote, lighten utilities' responsibility to manage risk and shift some of that burden to ratepayers. And for that reason, they would, quote, be expected to erode incentives for efficiency and cost controls, creating upward pressure on rates. So for these reasons, as a ratepayer advocate, the Citizens Utility Board respectfully recommends that the GUIC rider be sunset and that those routine investments be put back into rate cases for full review. Thank you very much.
All right. Any questions for the testifier? Okay. All right. Thank you. We have Justin Frey from Fresh Energy. If you want to come to the table and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. My name is Justin Fay, and I'm here today representing Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit, and our organization regularly participates in regulatory proceedings at the Public Utilities Commission. Fresh Energy recommends that the GUIC rider be sunset, and so we're opposed to the language in the House File 3830 as currently written. Like other utility riders, the GUIC rider allows gas utilities to recover certain infrastructure replacement costs outside of the comprehensive review that occurs in a general rate case. However, in the many years since this rider was established, the policy context surrounding the gas system has evolved significantly, and Minnesota regulators are actively examining the future of the gas system through several ongoing processes. At the same time, gas customers are facing rising energy bills, and there is growing uncertainty about the cost and long-term role of the gas system. Emerging technologies that can provide cleaner heating options are also likely to affect future gas demand and infrastructure needs. In this environment, accelerating spending on gas infrastructure through automatic riders is increasingly misaligned with Minnesota's broader market, regulatory, and policy landscape. Our state is not unique in this regard, as other states, including Colorado, have recently eliminated their equivalent gas infrastructure riders. It is also important to note that the expiration of the rider would not remove utilities' obligation to maintain safe and reliable service or create any new barriers to completing investments that improve and address safety. Rather, it would ensure that major infrastructure investments receive comprehensive review through the traditional regulatory process. At a time of rising gas bills, utility investments warrant heightened scrutiny with long-term system planning in mind, not expedited cost recovery. For these reasons, Fresh Energy encourages the committee to maintain the existing sunset as approved by the legislature just 3 years ago, and vote no on the bill as currently written. Thank you.
All right, any questions for the testifier? All right. Dr. Pete Wyckoff, if you want to come before the committee, introduce yourself.
All right. Thank you, committee. Thank you, Chair Sudzinski, for having me today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on your bill. I am glad to hear from the previous interaction with a testifier that there is a compromise on the vendor part of the bill, so I will skip my comments on that part of the bill. I'm here to offer departmental concerns on the GUIC portions of the bill. As a general position, the department prefers to put as few costs in riders as possible. We believe it is better for ratepayers to have investments robustly analyzed through a fully litigated rate case, ensure that these investments are necessary, right size for the system, and affordable for ratepayers. Affordable natural gas is an important fuel for many of our existing large industrial customers to maintain a competitive marketplace. Availability of affordable natural gas service is critical for the state to continue to attract new businesses for economic development. With this in mind, the Department of Commerce is committed to ensuring investment in the system are carefully vetted so that the service and delivery costs for natural gas service remains affordable and competitive. As we've already discussed in this committee before, gas service and delivery charges have grown more than 30% in the last 15 years in Minnesota, largely driven by gas infrastructure investments. Given the pace of these investments, it is necessary to improve our regulatory oversight on gas infrastructure spending to protect ratepayers. Putting costs in rate cases rather than a rider allows the PUC and interveners and the public to have a better idea of the actual bill impacts of their decisions. When rates are set piecemeal in various rider proceedings, it is difficult to assess the overall customer bill impact. A rate case is handled through a robust proceeding with review of the record by an administrative law judge and sufficient time for expert analysis. By comparison, a rider proceeding is typically much quicker with less time for analysis, discovery, and no review by an administrative law judge. The GUIC rider is an annual filing. Since its inception, Xcel Energy has recovered more than $400 million in infrastructure investments through this rider. It is not an infrequently used rider by that one company. Since the rider was created in 2009, it has been extensively used by Xcel Energy, sparingly by Merck and Great Plains, and never by CenterPoint or any of our other gas companies. They have all managed to deliver safe and reliable energy to customers without utilizing this rider. And for that reason, we think it can sunset. When infrastructure costs are scrutinized in a full rate case, the Department of Commerce and other stakeholders are able to fully analyze the need and justification for the investments. A rate case assures scrutiny of the utility's costs and provides strong motivation for the utility to control these costs between rate cases. That is why the department feels it is time to let this rider expire, as current statute calls.
Are you available for questions?
Sure.
So how much?
That's my line, Representative Sexton.
I'm sorry,
Chair. Representative Sexton, do you have a question?
I do.
Okay.
I'm just curious if you had a comparison of rate of inflation over the last 15 years compared to the cost of gas, natural gas.
So,
Mr. Wyckoff.
Sorry. Chair Swedzinski. Thank you, sir. I do not have the numbers exactly in front of me, so I don't want to misquote them. I did present them to this committee several weeks ago. I know that last year natural gas inflation was the number one driver of inflation in the United States.
Sure. Representative Sexton. Yeah.
Absolutely. I would love to get the citing for that,
yeah,
if I could.
All right. Are there any other questions for the testifier? All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Next on the list, we have Kevin Pranis. If you'd like to come up and introduce yourself before the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Sexton, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Pranis. I represent Liona, Minnesota, and North Dakota. We're an organization that represents more than 14,000 construction laborers living all across the state. Obviously, we have many interactions with the gas system. Lots of our members are customers of and pay those same bills. But, you know, in particular, we have about 800 or 1,000 members who earn their living building and maintaining the gas system, primarily distribution lines for these utilities. And so we're the people who do that work. And when we talk about the investment that the state makes, it is our members going out there replacing those pipes, relocating those pipes to support public works improvements. So this is important to us as well as other unions like the operating engineers, gas workers, et cetera. I think, you know, we've heard a lot about this. I would just say that from our perspective, I think everyone agrees, these are absolutely critical improvements that we're making here. There's only two kinds of things that we're funding with this program. One, with the GUIC rider. One is safety improvements. We used outdated materials for years, right? Kinds of plastic that didn't hold up well over time, that exhibited cracking, that you would eventually get gas explosions. There was a lot of work done, you know, at the federal level to recognize what those materials were and a mandate for every utility in the entire country to get them out of the ground at an appropriate schedule before there was risk to safety. That's what we do with the GUIC riders, we keep people safe. We keep the gas inside the pipes by replacing them with modern materials that don't have the same problems. The other thing that we're doing is we're doing relocation. So if somebody wants to do a roundabout, right, if there's a major, it was in St. Louis Park with Representative Kraft, where they torn up practically the entire middle of the town, right? There was like a pile of asphalt like to the sky. All kinds of utilities out there busy like digging out. It was amazing. It could barely get to the coffee shop. He remembers, I believe. But if you looked at all the utilities, Excel, CenterPoint, everyone else, because all these underground utilities have to be relocated, and it's the utility's obligation to relocate them. They can't say, well, you know what, you're going to have to wait 3 years because we don't have a budget for that this year. You have to do it when the locality wants it done. That's the work our members do. I would point, you know, we participate in rate cases regularly, and I would respectfully disagree with the claim that riders are not looked at or that rate cases provide a sort of overall solution. One of the advantages of riders is that they go up and down based on the need. So if there's more public works relocations happening in 1 year, it costs more that year. Then it can go down the next year. You don't necessarily want to set rates based on one big year of relocates, right? And the next year don't have them, the utility is collecting too much money. And so I think this is an appropriate tool. The last thing I would say about sunsets, sunset doesn't save anyone any money. All the sunset does is provide uncertainty to our members and contractors about whether those funds are going to be there. And the closer we get to a sunset, the more people have to decide, is there going to be work for me next year or in 2 years? That ends up being inefficient. I think it's unfair to the folks who do that work, and we hope that you'll consider supporting this bill. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Mr. Prentice? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I appreciate the St. Louis Park shout out, and it was a massive pile there. I do have to point out that CenterPoint serves St. Louis Park, so that wouldn't have been covered in any rider. I really appreciate all the work that you all do. That's so critical, but it is sort of compelling that this work gets done even in places quite well without riders, including the largest gas provider in Minnesota. So I guess that'd be just a comment. Thanks.
Sounds good. Are there any other questions? All right. Sounds good. Thank you. Are there any questions for the bill author? No? All right. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Akam?
I just want to make sure we have a roll call on this bill.
Okay,
please.
Sounds good. A roll call being called for. We will have a roll call on the bill. Any questions at all? All right. Sounds good. Yes, it would be remiss. There is also, members, there's a letter of, I think, either support in the packets from Minnesota Energy Resources. And if you want to take a gander at that on your free time, please do so. And with that, Representative Sexton, do you have any final comments on your bill?
I do. I was kind of hoping my testifiers might go into the nuts and bolts of really how this works. You know, it's on a three-year cycle. The first year, you look at what needs to be done. There's a lot of testing we do to make sure that, like was mentioned earlier, MAOP, can be certified at the proper level to move the gas through the pipelines. And when you have some doubts due to erosion and some things, you look at that as the primary areas you want to go back into. That's the planning year. And then you work on your bids in order to get your bids out and get the work. But you also have to go into municipalities. You have to work with their planning committees, with their engineers on staff and everything else. And then you finally get all that stuff put together. And then you get to the next year where you do the work. Now remember, this is Minnesota. You gotta have everything approved like 2 months ago because people are already mobilizing. Bayuna, all the other construction workers, because the weather's getting better and they wanna jump on that work. As you do the work, you find a lot of times more work is required. You find things you didn't expect underground. And that's why underground construction is getting so much more expensive. So then you do the work. If you get to where you finish the work early, you can actually slide to another municipality, do some work over there, and maybe get more done in one particular year than what you had originally planned. But it seems like the rider allows you to do this. And then the third year, you evaluate everything that was done during year two and reapply it into the planning for the next cycle. What makes it very cost effective, because I think that's the key here, is safety and cost effective, is this very deliberate cycle. Speaking as the former vice president of construction management for a pipeline company, the tighter I could build the scope of work, which is identifying where I had to work and exactly what the work was, and then going out to bid for it, the better cost I could get. The more that you make known as opposed to unknown, because it's underground, the lower cost for doing the work. Because those construction contractors, they don't like to absorb risk. They don't like to absorb the kind of risk where if you're the engineering firm and then you're going to hire them to do the actual work and then the engineering firm just manages it, if you're not providing them good drawings, a good idea of where all the other underground obstacles are so that they can work around those, they can't give you a good bid. They've got to cushion that bid, which drives the work costs up. And even though you're bidding it competitively, all of these contractors who are very familiar with the work are going to see those gaps of information. When you're on a very deliberate cycle like GUIC provides, you can mitigate that risk and actually lower the costs. If we allow this to expire, we will see costs go up because now we are shifting the planning cycle, which is going to be all over the place because of the way that we have taken it out of a very, very deliberate process. Work may start later. Not as much work may get done during a summer cycle. We'll have to push it off to following years. Then we're going to have to hire more contractors, which is more difficult and harder to manage, to catch up on that work. I believe, not only with San Bernardino, but our predecessors 20 years ago realized that this is actually the most efficient way to do this kind of work. And I'd love if a testifier would like to come back up and reinforce my statements. But I can tell you, I put a lot of bids together, multi-million dollars, and worked on a $3.2 billion pipeline. So as much information as you can get into this deliberate planning cycle and keep it there, the lower the cost to a ratepayer. And I am a ratepayer. So I fully support this bill, and I think by the direction we're going, by possibly not passing this bill, we're going to cause an unintended effect, which is less safety and higher cost, because we're adding risk to those contractors, and they don't like that. Thank you very much. I re-refer.
Just hold on, Representative Sexton. Before you make your motion, your speech gave us some inspiration on questions, so we're going to jump back into that. So, all right, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sexton. I guess my question is twofold, because this bill is, relatively new, 2013. Yep. So how are we doing this and keeping people safe and keeping costs down prior to the GUIC? And also, how do other states work without a GUIC? I'm curious, because we're saying that this is very necessary and that if we don't do this, everything's going to fall apart. But the reality is, this is as old as my oldest kit. We didn't have this before then. So how did it function before?
Representative Sexton, or if there's a testifier that wants to...
There's a testifier, go ahead.
Mr. Gardner, if you want to come up, just reintroduce yourself for the committee, and if you need representative to repeat the question or if you caught it, excellent.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Ray Gardner, Area Vice President, Gas Engineering at Xcel Energy. So a little bit of context, a lot of the work that is done under the GUIC is a product of federal regulation that came in the 2000s. So the Gas Distribution Integrity Management Rule came into effect in 2010. And then the Gas Transmission Integrity Management Rule was officially published in 2002 and had assessment requirements that went initial baseline assessments through 2012. And then it has continual reassessment requirements on seven-year intervals. So a piece of the answer to your question is if you go back in time prior to, some of those regulations didn't exist, and so that's part of the piece. I think the other thing that's important to consider is, and goes to Representative Kraft's comment earlier about how do other utilities do this, and really the short answer comes down to the frequency of rate cases. So if you have a rider in place that allows you to fluctuate up and down, specifically if I'm looking at the mandated relocation topic that we're talking about, the rider allows you to fluctuate up and down depending on the work that's going on in the municipality. If you're doing it through a rate case mechanism, that generally drives the utility to file rate cases on a much more frequent basis. So think in terms of either every year, every other year, something like that, versus once every 5 years or something, you know, a much more extended duration. So the last thing I'd say to kind of help answer some of that too is when we talk about rate cases versus riders and a lot of the viewpoint on those, the GUIC is unique in the amount of structure that goes into it. And specifically, you know, Xcel Energy partnered with stakeholders, like I mentioned earlier, with the Department of Commerce as well as the Office of Attorney General to go through and set up performance metrics. So we have performance metrics that monitor, we have cost effectiveness metrics that look at things like unit costs for putting in pipe or making repairs. And we also have performance metrics that look at making sure we're getting the work done in a prudent manner. So you have both of those levers that really don't exist in a rate case. And then similarly, we worked with stakeholders on establishing a mutually agreeable risk assessment process to help govern what actually goes into this rider. So again, that's another piece that really doesn't exist in a traditional rate case.
Representative Hollins, you have a follow-up to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I suppose my follow-up is, can you, and I think the testifier is the best person to answer this, can you help me understand the urgency around this? Because this isn't due to expire until, right? You've got it for another 2 years. So what, I don't understand the urgency. Can you help me understand that?
Representative Sexton or Gardner?
I'm trying, whoever would.
Sure, Chair. And Representative, I would say it's very much about planning and making sure that we understand what's coming ahead. So the sunset date is the middle of 2028, if I recall correctly. And so when we look at making plans for work, when we look at, so our next GUIC filing will be November of 2026. And then after that would be November of 27. So to your point, there may be some runway there, but at the same time, it's very much about planning for the future and understanding from a utility standpoint of what's coming.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Less of a question than a comment, but I kind of feel like this rider is the least of your concerns with planning right now, given the state of the world and the tariffs that are in place and whatnot. But I hear what you're saying. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Akam, or Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Gardner. I think one of the other testifiers today mentioned that a similar rider expired in Colorado. Could you maybe share a little bit of background about why?
Mr. Gardner?
Yeah, Chair and Representative. It's a great question. It is something that the state of Colorado did have what was referred to as, it was a pipeline safety rider that was in place. That rider had, it was a little bit different in its construction as far as the work that was going through it. You know, it was something that frankly, in my role, I would have much preferred that we kept the rider, but the commissioners did decide to sunset that. From my lens, what I see now that it has been sunsetted has been that when we look at a lot of the work that we do to try and meet like climate policy goals, not having the rider actually, in my opinion, makes that more difficult because it kind of convolutes work together versus having a structure around here's the day-to-day maintenance work to keep the system running. and then having things like new business and capacity work that we can look at for evaluating alternatives and really pushing those climate goals. So I'm not sure that that completely answered your question, but it was definitely a Public Utilities Commission decision.
Yeah.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and I will just say from some reading I'm doing here, it seems as though they found it not necessary to maintain the safety and reliability of the gas system. And so I appreciate what you're saying, but to your point, the Public Utility Commission felt that they had the tools they need to be able to maintain a safe and reliable system. And then I just have a question for the bill author, and that's, I think I heard from a couple of the testifiers that there was maybe some peace in the valley on some of the information, or excuse me, the language on line 2.7 in terms of vendor name and information. And so maybe this is a question and a comment. What is maybe clarification about the motion? And because there is interest in working on that provision, would you consider laying it over to continue working on that?
Representative Saxton, would you be interested in laying the bill over or promise that you'll work on it between?
I will promise to work on it before it gets to the floor.
Yeah.
It sounds like if we can secure peace in the valley, we can certainly do that.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say I appreciate promises. I think it's better to get assurances. And so I'm going to encourage our members to vote no on voting this out, I think for a number of reasons. I think that we are at a moment in time with, as was talked to by the Department of Commerce, with increased gas costs that we need to be scrutinizing through rate cases, the investments that our gas utilities are making. And so I would encourage members to vote no. And so thank you.
Any final comments, Representative Sexton?
No final comments.
All right. Representative Sexton renews his motion that House File 3830 be referred to the General Register, and a roll call being asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Swidzinski.
Aye.
Chair Akam.
No.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kraft.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Baker.
Baker, aye.
Representative Buck.
No.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Igo.
Igo, aye.
Representative Jones, absent, excused. Representative Luger, Nikolai.
No.
Representative Mahmoud.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Sexton.
Aye.
Representative Weiner.
Aye.
All right. Not having received 9 votes, the bill is not referred to the General Register and it is laid over. Representative Sexton. All right. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3688. Representative Sexton, please move your bill.
Thank you, Chair Swidzinski. I wish to move House File 3688, Energy Conservation Programs for Low-Income Households, in front of the committee for further referral to the General Register.
All right. Representative Sexton, do you have an amendment that you would like to move to get the bill in the shape that you would like it to be in?
I would absolutely like to move my amendment, House File 3688-DE1.
All right, Representative Sexton moves that House File 3688 be referred to the General Register, and Representative Sexton moves that the DE1 amendment. All in favor to the DE1 amendment to House File 3688, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. All right, the bill is in the shape you'd like. Representative Sexton, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Swidzinski. House File 3688 is a logical update to our current laws and supported by many of our energy industry partners, as well as our consumer advocacy members. I would like to specifically thank Allie Ellers from the Center for Energy and Environment, as well as Mr. Bob Eliff from nonpartisan staff for greatly simplifying the bill. It reads much better now. Thank you. Prior to hearing the testimony, I want to highlight the fiscal note, which shows no cost to implement this bill. And second, I would like to invite Ms. Annie Levinson-Falk, Executive Director for Citizens Utility Board, to please join me at the testifier table.
And if you'd like to come before the committee, and thanks for doing my work for me again, Representative Sexton. You're gonna do great things, I have a feeling. So, all right.
Just gotta speed it up.
Sounds good, buddy. You just wanna take this and just run the whole show? Jeez Louise. All right. All right. If you'd like to introduce yourself with the committee, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sexton and members, again, I'm Annie Levinson-Falk, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, and I'll be very brief. I think this is a very good bill. There is a ton of opportunity to save money by fuel switching, particularly in rural areas and homes that depend on delivered fuels, and that's exactly who would benefit from this bill. So if we're able to do more to get some of those programs out to low-income households and cooperative and municipal utility areas, that's a great idea. So I'm happy to support this bill.
All right. Are there any questions for the testifier? All right. Is there any representative? Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the bill author. I have talked to several of the organizations that work in this space, and they all feel like this is a worthwhile change. My question for you is, why isn't there a Senate author?
Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair Szczesinski. You know, I'm not quite sure. I was so focused on presenting the bill that I did not check that. So thanks for that mentoring. I think I can find one pretty easily.
I believe the jackets may have been sent to Senator Matthews' office. So I'm not sure where that, you never know. So. Representative Bacon.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad to see that there will be. Just we need to remember we can't do anything alone here. So work on that. Thank you.
That's right. Any other questions for Representative Sexton? All right. Are there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? All right. There also is a letter of support within the packet from Great River Energy. Representative Sexton, do you have any final comments on your bill?
I would just say that this seems like an overall win-win for both our ratepayers and the utilities, and can't wait to see it implemented.
Representative Sexton, would you like to renew your motion as well?
Yes, Chair, I'd like to renew my motion for House File 3688 as amended to be referred to the General Register.
Representative Sexton reduces motion to House File 3688 as amended be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the General Register. All right. The next item on the agenda is we have Representative Baker is going to have a conversation about net metering. And so Representative Baker, if you want to come to the testifiers table, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Let me just get set up here a little bit. So we're coming to the committee today without a bill that we're moving along, but we wanted to bring everybody up to speed on a lot of conversations that have been happening around the net metering language and policy. Again, I respect our two new members on our committee this year that maybe haven't heard all the conversations going on in the last year around this. This has been talked about for quite a while. And I just wanted to kind of maybe just reset it. I'm disappointed today because I don't have sort of like, if we can call it sort of a master agreement or peace in the valley or, there you go, sorry about that. But we're getting there. And I want to say that we're not giving up on this because we've come a long way and both sides aren't totally happy with everything in it, but I think we're really making some really good progress. So I'll just kick it out this way. I've asked Mr. Jans is going to make just a short brief overview of this, but I just want to talk about the urgency of this thing. This is about affordability with rates, especially in greater Minnesota with our co-ops and our munis, about the need to be not the last, we are the last state in the union that is paying full retail back from rates that are excessive after the user of the rooftop solar units is utilizing those rates, and we're the only state left doing that, which is causing rates to be higher than they ought to be or should be on the co-op meters because they're buying, they're forced to buy the higher rates at retail. Now, I say that because there's a lot of things that went into this, and this is, again, it's been a long time coming. And we are coming a long ways to come up with a deal that kind of grandfathers folks in, and we can do some different pricing of the retail, aggregate some meters, and I think we're just going to kind of move along here with kind of where are we at with this. But I have to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed working with the co-ops and the munis on this issue, with my friends at Mencia and the folks that really want to make sure this thing works really, really well. But we're not quite there yet, but I felt it was important, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, to kind of give you guys an update of where we are actually at. So, again, we could talk all day long about things that we can't control. We can bicker about solar rates and how do we get them at the right rate. The biggest issue right now with solar is it's got a fabulous future, but we can't harness solar energy when we don't need it, and we can't utilize it at that time. So it's all about the demand and when we really need it at the time we need it. That's our major hurdle right now. So today I'll turn it over to Mr. Jans, Mr. Chair, and he can give us kind of an overview of that. We're getting closer, and I hope that we can still have more conversations, and I'll open it up for more questions, and I'll have more comments at a later point. I know we've got some good testifiers, so, Mr. Chair, sure. I'll turn it over to Mr. Jans. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Baker, for your work on this issue. We appreciate your due diligence in bringing stakeholders together and having conversations that quite frankly, still need some bridging when it comes to finding some common ground. And it is an issue that we do need to address. And we do have a list of folks that have came forward early and want to chat with us. So with that, we have Justin Johns, CEO of East Central Energy. I believe you have a slide if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee, and you can proceed with your presentation. We'd appreciate it. So,
Chair Swedinski, thank you. Chair Aikum, thank you for having me here, and members, thank you for the opportunity. Justin Johns, East Central Energy. I'm the president and CEO. We serve 68,000 homes and businesses in East Central Minnesota, probably a total of around 150,000 residents of the state, and MREA, the co-ops, serve about 1.7 million members of the state. So net metering is a big issue, and I was fortunate enough to participate in Mencia's annual meeting on a panel, and I'd like to tell you that at least outside of this building, there is, I think, a compromise, and I'm hopeful that we can get there. There's a lot of common interest around solar in this state. It's been shown to be successful in certain applications. And I'd like to talk a little bit today about kind of giving you a peek behind the curtain into how it affects rates and how it impacts our co-op. And I want to be clear that I'm speaking only on behalf of East Central Energy's rates, our rate structure, and how that works. We also function under an NDA with our power supplier. So I want you to know that a lot of these things are averaged and annualized, but they are relatively accurate. And so although they're not precision numbers, they're about as close as I can get without getting in trouble. So we'll get into that. So when we bill our members, there are two functions that they pay for. One is our cost of basic, which is currently $46, and our energy rate, which averages 13 cents. And so when we buy back solar energy, the state law today takes that $46 off the table, and we're only required to calculate our average rate based on the energy component. And so today that's 13 cents. And so that's really the subject of this conversation, is 13 cents the right number? And so what I'm going to do here is break that number down, that 13 cents, to give you an explanation of how that number is derived, at least at a high level. And so essentially 4 cents of that 13 is a cost mechanism or a recovery mechanism for those who may be larger users. So if you're an average user, you're going to pay $46 plus, let's say, 800 kilowatt hours worth of that 4 cents to cover the entire cost of what it takes to serve you. Anyone who uses more might have a larger transformer. They contribute to larger wire sizes, larger substations, and so they pay incrementally more for the electricity that they use because it's above and beyond the average. So in other words, it's somewhat of a penalty or a higher cost for those who are higher users and contribute more cost to the system. So now we're down to the 9 cents which is essentially our power supply. So if you took all of ECE's energy, everything we buy from GRE, and again, you kind of average that all out, it's going to be around 9 cents. That's what we pay GRE for 24/7, 365 power throughout the course of the year. But that power supply can be broken down into three essential functional components. The first is capacity. And think of capacity as having the light switch turn the lights on when it's 20 below zero, 3 o'clock in the morning. Then you need that light to come on. You need that furnace to run. That's capacity is the availability of power 24/7, 365. That's about 30% of our power supply cost. About 20% of our power supply cost is transmission. And transmission, as you can imagine, is the transport of electricity from the generation resource to our substations. And so that, again, is about 20%. Now, solar does not provide 24/7, 365 capacity. I'm guessing tonight the sun is going to set in the west and most solar will fall off the grid in terms of production. We know that. We expect that. But it doesn't. So solar doesn't provide that 24/7 capacity. Transmission, solar does also not provide that. Now, does it erode some of the transmission cost? Yes, but a lot of transmission is fixed. You just have to have it, and we need it to be available. But energy, and this is the good news about solar, it is pretty much a one-for-one commodity, right? Our energy is energy is energy, and so if we can produce it locally, it can be very valuable to us. And so when you look at our 9 cents, about 50% of that cost is the actual commodity going down the lines in the form of energy. And so as we've had conversations about developing a new solution to net metering, these are some numbers that we're thinking about on the utility side of what might be reasonable and how we could come to a workable solution. So I guess to wrap it up here, solar really is an energy resource in our mind. It doesn't provide capacity. It doesn't provide reduce our transmission costs as a whole, but we do recognize it as an energy resource. In fact, East Central Energy is developing many large-scale solar products, solar arrays, and we're doing it with providers who are part of Mencia, a lot of them, and we're finding ways to make it viable for our membership, and it's been very successful. So our cooperative is pro-solar. We just want to pay a fair price for that solar. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just mentioned that your cooperative is building some solar. So who owns that solar? Is that owned by you?
Mr.
That,
Johns.
Yes, Chair. Chair Akam, we can't do anything affordably, it seems like. And so we actually do that on a power purchase agreement. So those arrays are owned by a third-party developer. We enter into power supply contracts with them and purchase the energy directly from the owner.
Okay, Chair Akam.
Thank you.
Sounds good. All right. Any other questions? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker and Mr. Johns. Can you go back to the equipment costs, 4 cents per kilowatt hour?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Can you explain that again? So you have costs that everyone pays because of having large users? Is that the way? Am I thinking about that right?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Kraft. So essentially that $46 plus the average use at 4 cents would be the cost that we expect the average member to pay to keep the grid kind of alive, if you will, right? And so if everyone installed solar today and we could only collect that $46 plus that 4 cents, which is essentially a distribution cost. So when you think about the cost, this 9 cents that I've been talking about is our power supply cost. This 4 cents is part of our distribution system costs, or ECE's operational costs associated with the supply of that electricity, not just the infrastructure itself. I may have not made it any clearer for you based on the look.
Representative Kraft for a follow-up. You appear to need a follow-up.
Yeah, so I will have, and I probably won't get there because I'm a little thick on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johns, so if you said that, but then why did you write it here with large users and higher demand users? Like, those seem to be two different answers you just gave, and my head exploded a little bit.
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Kraft, they are two different groups. So higher demand users tend to be higher energy users, but not always. And this is why, and I think you'll hear from later testifiers, the evolution of three-part rates. In other words, charging demand charges to folks based on their individual non-coincident peaks. In other words, their individual peak. That would be a component that we would likely take out of our volumetric energy rate and put into a per kW demand charge. Think of it like the speedometer on your car versus the odometer on your car. Right now we bill on the odometer, but we would start to bill on the fastest speed or the highest demand that you had at any time during the month. So that component, that 4 cents, part of that would be that speedometer reading.
Okay. Representative Kraft.
I'm good for now.
All right. Any other questions for the testifier? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get a kind of a handle on, you know, what the neighbors pay for the other neighbor's solar. So 13 cents is your rate that everybody's charged. And at the end of the day, the percent that goes just to energy would be half of 9%, nine cents, or 4.5 cents. So that's the cost of energy. Everything else was the 20% for the transmission. That's all shared benefit. The 30% for capacity to have lights on when there's no sunshine, that's shared. And so the rest of those are all shared expenses, but we're giving that difference directly back to the solar, the person that has the rooftop solar or solar. And so that the two numbers there, 13 cents less half of that nine is 4.5. That means there's 9.5% that one neighbor has to pay another neighbor to have solar on his house. Does that make sense to you?
Mr. Johns?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative. It's 8.5 cents, according to these calculations, and again, they're rounded, but essentially the utility construct and the development of rates has a long history of trying to have simplicity and fairness at the same time, and it can be difficult, but I think your analysis is pretty close to the truth. Now, there's other intangible values of solar potentially, but we are signing power purchase agreements that are far, far below, like less than half of our all-in energy price to our members. So that's maybe a simpler analysis to say we're doing utility scale solar at less than half the price of our retail rate, and we don't think our members should subsidize the arrays of those who can afford to put them in.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree 100%. I think that's the real difference. We all have these shared expenses for delivering electricity to our house. And so when we're saying we're going to pay you at the full retail that we paid, that means that you don't have to pay any of that. So the burden's on the rest of the people that don't have the rooftop solar. That's the problem. It's really about equity.
Mr. Johns. Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would agree that that's true. And, you know, if rates are evolving, we're changing the way that we bill our members, and I think that'll be part of the ongoing dialogue of this issue. But we're definitely looking for progress on the current state in Minnesota, as 49 other states have already done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Next up, we have Logan O'Grady with NCIA. If you want to introduce yourself. Mr. Johns, you can stay there if you want, or maybe the next person on the list, the dueling, could come up after that. If you want to introduce yourself to the committee, I think you, Mr. Grady, you have also have a handout, so in a presentation, so we'll let you load that up. So.
Mr. Chair, trying to get set up.
Yeah, sounds good.
All righty. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. I have the privilege of representing the 5,000 Minnesotans that work within and throughout all of your communities, helping your constituents lock in their energy prices by going solar. I actually had notes to say almost exactly what these two just said from the beginning, and I just wanted to make it clear that we do talk to each other outside of this building. As Justin said, we were invited to their CEO's meeting. We had a good time. They were invited to our conference. Derek from MREA and Jenny came to our board meeting, so we have been actively trying to build trust, which I think is essential, and create a relationship where we can have these conversations. I do this for a living, and I'm confused, right, by the numbers that are being thrown out, and that's what I think makes this conversation so complex and time-consuming, is we have to walk through what does the 9 cents mean and include, and what doesn't it, and it doesn't always translate the first time we do it, so we got to keep trying. Thank you, Representative Baker. Your door has always been open to us to come to you and talk, so we do appreciate that. I think what I wanted to do today was just sort of level set of what net metering is and why Minnesota was the first state in the nation to pass that enabling legislation, why we think it's fair, and kind of our disagreement with how the utilities value it. So what net metering actually is compensation for a service provided to utility by its own customers. So when a home and business or a farm generates more power than they produce from their solar system, that gets exported to the grid and used by their neighbors. That generator of energy should be credited for the benefit that they just provided to the utility and their neighbors. And I think we can have discussions about what that rate should be for the credit, but inherently, we believe it should be what that solar owner pays for their energy, because most solar owners also buy energy from the utility at different times of the year or continuously. If they're a farmer and they're a large power user and they have a solar system, that generally doesn't cover their entire electric costs. So again, providing a utility with power from a system paid for by that person with their own private capital provides several benefits to the public in the utility. It slashes their need for expensive power during peak times that they buy oftentimes from an out-of-state provider. It reduces the reliance on out-of-state fossil fuels. It avoids efficiency losses when you transfer energy hundreds of miles over state borders. And it avoids infrastructure investments that are ultimately passed on to ratepayers, so new power plants, maintaining aging power plants, and building costly transmission lines for millions of dollars and years of permitting. You'll often hear about this cost shift that happens, where solar owners are subsidized by non-solar owners, and homes with solar don't pay their fair share of grid upkeep. There's a flaw in this logic on how, and the flaw is about how utilities charge for electricity and the incentives and restrictions of their business models. As Mr. Jans, or is it Johns?
Johns
said, there's three ways that they pay for that. The first is a basic service charge. Regardless of how much energy you use, you pay it. And then the volumetric energy charges that you pay per unit consumed. And then solar owners in a lot of places have a third way that they're paying for this through grid access fees. Due to the volumetric charge, any reduction in energy at all, whether it's from efficient appliances, new windows, new efficient air conditioner, threatens that utility's revenue from those charges. Yet, when we talk about energy efficiency, people love that, right? But when you talk about solar, it's all of a sudden a cost shift. So the core issue here is outdated pricing models, not consumer-owned solar. So utilities often look at one side of the ledger when they calculate this. They measure only the foregone revenue, the money that they didn't collect from that solar owner. They ignore other sides of the equation, such as massive avoided costs for expensive peak power and expensive new substations. And we are told that we shouldn't count solar for these avoided costs. But when utilities tell you their wholesale price per kilowatt hour, they are often leaving out these costs. Whereas net metering, we often say, is the full apple pie, right? You're comparing apples to baked apple pie. Just go with me on a little analogy here. If you think about a state toll road, I know we don't have them here, but I lived in Illinois for a little bit and I paid $2 per trip that I took. If people want to work from home or carpool, they're now paying less. So the toll authority is going to go to the state legislature panicking and say, our revenue is falling because not as many cars are on the road. What they're not telling you is because there's less traffic, there's less wear and tear on the road, so they don't need to maintain it as much and they don't need to make an expensive upgrade to add a lane to that road. So in the end, the toll authority and the people that are choosing not to drive as much are saving everyone money. I think it's important, and it's been brought up in this committee a couple times this session, to understand where this resistance comes from. And I think you need to understand IOU incentives as well as cooperative restrictions. So as a reminder, investor-owned utilities make their profits through building infrastructure. Consumer-owned solar lowers the need for that infrastructure. So there's a fundamentally a natural tension that begins here because the utility's business model is being affected by less people buying energy. Co-ops, however, have a different business model, right? They don't have the profit motive there. They generally want to serve their members, and I think overall they do a good job at that. The issue we see here is rigid long-term contracts, often 30 to 75 years, that require them to buy a minimum amount of energy from oftentimes an out-of-state massive wholesale provider. So these are minimum purchase thresholds, and they face financial penalties if they don't meet those. When a co-op member owner installs solar, the overall load drops, and their minimum purchases are affected by that. But we have seen in Minnesota some co-ops reject these long-term contracts. Conexus Energy is a perfect example of where they canceled their long-term out-of-state wholesale provider contracts because they realized they could actually save everyone money by utilizing the power their own member owners were creating on their rooftops. I think this is a perfect place that the legislature could focus on how to give these utilities more flexibility in those contracts and actually introduce competition into our market. So I'll wrap up here. I know I've taken a long time. I think we have to look beyond the single line item here. I think when you look at a whole system, you're balancing not just the energy you're generating, but the capacity, the reliability, environmental compliance, and also investment risk. Consumer-owned solar impacts all of those dimensions as well. And so a narrow focus on retail rate comparisons overlook the many benefits that solar provides. I recognize, and the solar recognizes, that as our energy system evolves, our rates need to evolve with it. We would like to see utilities do more thorough cost of service analyses and make those public so we can see when we're talking about this issue what the cost actually is that's happening, if any, and then we can have a better conversation on how to move forward. I can be here for questions, but...
Good. Are there any questions for Mr. O'Grady? Representative Sexton.
Really, it could be to either testifier. I have two questions, Chair. First one is, we keep talking about this grid access fee. Can you give us an idea of what that fee is? How much?
Mr. O'Grady or Mr. Johns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sexton, they're different in every single cooperative territory, and some don't even have it at all.
Representative Sexton.
Can you give us a band? Is it $4,000 a month or $100 a month? Or, I mean, we keep talking about the topic, but nobody talks about the impact. So,
Mr. Johns looks like he's raising his hand there.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Sexton. The 4 cents that I talked about that Representative Kraft and I were trying to work around, that is essentially some of what that cost recovery fee is. East Central Energy does not charge a fixed cost recovery fee. The reason is I don't believe that fundamentally people should be dissuaded from providing for their own electricity at their own house. Where the issue comes in for us is buying at 13 cents versus the price we can get on the market. So the fixed cost recovery fee is intended to recover that 4 cents that we were talking about. That's still a distribution cost. We don't implement it because, again, I think people should be able to provide for their own electricity at their home if they want to.
Representative Sexton.
So I guess I'll continue that rather than my second question. So my understanding, the grid access fee was really to help offset the cost that the co-op or the utility has to maintain those lines when they can't charge for that portion of that 4 cents. Your utility is choosing not to collect that for the electricity you're buying. So you really don't have a grid access fee, but it could be much different in other areas, what I'm sensing, because people continue to bring this topic up. Is that fair?
Is that a question, Representative Sexton?
I'm searching for a question because that was a surprising answer.
Mr. Johns?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, so if I can give you an example, I have 4 kids at my house. We use a ton of electricity. If I installed a 6-megawatt solar array or 6-kilowatt solar array on my house, we would likely consume all of the electricity.
Correct.
The little old lady that lives next door to me would not consume all of that electricity. So
it would be appropriate, according to how the model has been derived on fixed cost recovery, that she would actually pay that fee because she's exporting electricity to the grid. But I would be paying the fee as well, even though I'm consuming every ounce of that electricity at my house, if that helps.
Absolutely.
That's why we don't charge the fee, because it isn't equitably applied to the same size array if it's on different homes.
Sure. Representative Sexton.
If I could, Chair, a second question. This is Mr. Johns. How often in the scope of the day with everything do you buy solar that you don't really need because you already have bought maybe the previous day a certain amount of electricity from your operator to provide to you, so your consumers are just not using it. So you're actually eating those costs at a retail value as opposed to a wholesale value you're getting at from your regular provider.
Mr. Johns?
Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't think it's quite that bad. In other words, essentially what's happening is we have a 10% self-supply option, and we're able to produce or purchase from members who are overproducing. So essentially, instead of buying at, you know, my rough number of 50% of 9 cents, we're buying it at 13 cents.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? And just another, go ahead, Representative Murphy.
I just have one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one more question. Your cost of doing business is nowhere in here yet either, right? I mean, you have employees, they have benefits, they paid family leave, everything's in there. That's not in here anywhere, is it, yet?
Is that to Mr. Johns?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the $46 along with that 4 cents covers essentially East Central Energy's operating costs. Our cost of doing business, maintaining the poles, going out at 2 in the morning, putting a new pole in the ground, that's in that $46 and that 4 cents. So those costs are fundamentally removed. But if you think about it, if everybody produced enough electricity through solar to offset all of their own energy use and their $46 cost, who's going to pay the linemen? Who's going to pay, you know, for the poles and the transformers and all the things that need to be done on the grid? If, you know, and that's kind of my, you know, kind of integrity component on this is if everybody did it, would it be okay? And the answer is clearly no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to that point, Mr. Johns, how much solar, how much rooftop solar is within your district? What percent?
Mr. Johns.
Of your customers?
Mr. Chair, Chair Akam, I don't have the number right offhand. It's a low amount, which I think is, you know, the point of the question. It's a very low amount. But it's growing. Interest is growing. I think, you know, for example, my own son drew a thing at school about where his dad worked, and he drew wind turbines, right? Mm-hmm. Which speaks to how people are viewing electricity. But the reality is we need 24/7, 365 power. And so we've got to talk, I think, honestly and objectively about how we're going to do that in the future.
Chair Akam?
Yes, please. Just a quick follow-up. I think that with wind, with solar, with storage, it is becoming more reliable, and especially with longer-term battery storage. But I wanted to make just a quick comment, if I may, about the grid access fees. And I think the variability is part of the problem. And so I think a lot of that information is not easily accessible to the public. And so I think that there have been, you know, questions and interest over the years to provide a little transparency to that, and maybe even put some guardrails around how and how much that might be done. So anyway, just wanted to kind of point the other side of sure. the grid access fee. Thank you.
And I would just add to that too. You know, I think one of the things that we're forgetting here, as you know, elected officials, is that cooperatives are unique in the fact that they are also elected officials. So, you know, Mr. Johns does not work for a bunch of appointed people. He works for folks that were elected by other members. And I think that's really the disconnect that this whole conversation has, is that whether it's access fees, whether it's accessibility, whether it's like Conexus chooses to do whatever Conexus does, that, you know, these are autonomous, right? I mean, they're represented by their own people, regardless of what they do. And so when we're saying there's not transparency, there is absolutely transparency in this. Now, the only problem is when the legislature has gotten involved in this conversation, right? We're dictating to other elected officials within rural co-ops and telling them that we know best.
And I think that's where we need to step back and say, you know, I understand that solar, you know, 20 or 5 or how many, 10 years ago, was a fledgling thing. It's not, right? Almost every single testifier in front of this committee says it's the cheapest thing to do. Okay, well, then why are we making it more expensive? All right, any other questions? All right, Mr. Dooling from Blue Horizon Energy, or Griffin. You want to come before the committee? Introduce yourself.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, thank you. Chair Acom, good to see you. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Griffin Dooling. I'm the CEO of Blue Horizon Energy. I also serve on the board of Mencia. We work across the United States, but Minnesota is our home market, and the vast majority of our projects are here, and the vast majority of our projects in Minnesota are with cooperative utilities. And so we've worked a lot with Mr. Johnson's team at East Central Energy. They do a very good job. I've got good news for him. Your current solar penetration is 1.1%. So all those folks are very, very safe from the overrun of solar that we're concerned about here today. I'd just like to add some context here, right? So East Central Energy is pretty much an average utility here in the state of Minnesota with that 1.1% penetration rate. That is the roughly the statewide average for folks that have chosen to deploy these projects. The highest is in a small utility in southern Minnesota, about 3%. And when we look at that, we've got quite a bit of room to run. You know, a lot of these utility contracts, as Mr. John said, have a 10%, you know, self-supply option. And so that, you know, is, you know, if you look at that as a ceiling on what you can reasonably do within your district from DERs, you know, we can do 10x more solar, and it's taken us 40 years to get here. So even if we continue to double the pace of deployment over the next several decades, it'll take us 40 more years to get to 10%. So, you know, overall, I would say, you know, we're at a pace of deployment where I think we should be asking the question of, you know, we have big goals for the state, both in terms of economic development that needs power and in clean energy that needs to come online. How do we encourage folks to bring projects online in their homes and businesses that can help us pursue that goal? Every dollar that a private citizen or private business can invest in clean energy is a dollar that does not have to be rate-based and spread across the entire community. So there's an efficiency there that I think we should look at. One of the pieces that I also wanted to just touch on here is this idea of the concern being folks are being paid more than the value of this power. And so when you look at the state here today, we have 12,000 systems outside of Xcel Energy in the municipal and cooperative utilities, total 12,000 solar systems, DERs technically, so some of those could be possibly wind, but solar is the vast majority. Last year, the engineers for the cooperative utilities testified that about 1,600 of those are larger than 20 kilowatts, and therefore they felt like might be oversized. Reality is a lot of those 1,600 are probably family farms that need the power, or, you know, small machine shops in rural communities that need the power. So say half of those are appropriately sized. It leaves you with 800 folks that are maybe oversized. A share of those folks that have oversized their systems could be, you know, the homeowner that has, you know, young children and is expecting them to grow and is expecting their energy use to increase. Some of those systems could be folks that are planning to buy EVs or get electric vehicles or, you know, do electrification in their businesses. So, you know, I think we should set aside a group of that. So we end up with about 400 projects potentially in the state of Minnesota that might be legitimately oversized and just sort of profiteering, trying to make that margin on that excess power. So that's about 3% of projects deployed in Minnesota today. So 3% of 1%. So 3/100ths of 1% of Minnesota might have a system that's too large for their needs. So this is a very, very small problem today. And I think that it deserves the attention to do this right and be very, very careful with how we modify the net metering law so that we can find ways to improve it. And I think as we've shared today, we agree that there's a lot of opportunities to improve it. There's ways that we can improve transparency. There's ways that we can help bring in new technologies like storage to improve the capacity factor for these systems. There's ways that we can increase you know, access to these systems and capacity in our distribution system. But ultimately, all of that conversation is a lot of moving pieces. And one piece that you just wanted to talk about in terms of the 9 cents that we spoke about in East Central Energy's case for their power supply. So I think we pretty much have alignment that, you know, 50% of that is energy cost. That's 4.5 cents. 30% of that was capacity costs. Now, the MISO system, which is sort of the supra regulator over the sort of central region here in the United States, applies a capacity factor of 50% to solar energy 9 months out of the year. So that's about another cent and a half in terms of this value stream here. And then, you know, I think as we've talked about, in that 20% for transmission and distribution, solar is providing some value. It's not 100%. So let's call it 50%. That's another 1 cent. So that ends up with 7 cents out of that 9 cents being, in my opinion, pretty defensible. And then you start talking about, okay, avoided investments, you know, energy system decarbonization, these sorts of other benefits that are maybe a little tougher to quantify. And so overall, I think you're in a place where the value is not this difference between 13 cents and 2 cents as it was last year when we were talking about this. You know, now it sounds like we're 13 cents to 7 cents, so we're narrowing the gap. And I think ultimately we can get to a place where the solar and the DERs are appropriately incentivized while also avoiding this sort of motive to overbuild systems for those 0.03% of Minnesota that have done that. Happy to address questions. Really appreciate the conversation today and appreciate the opportunity to highlight some data.
Representative Kraft. Mr. Johns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, to your comment at first about, you know, imagine a world where everybody did it, California was on that path, and that's why they got rid of their net metering laws, frankly. It was just, you get this duck back curve that causes chaos in the ISO. So I don't want to imagine that world. But to your question, we are, in fact, one of our premier solar developers, a guy that we've worked with the most, actually started as a net metering member who was also an installer. And as we've talked with him and like the testifier that just spoke, common sense started to come out of this. I mean, I agree with about 80% of what he just said. And there is a solution here, but we've got to get to that solution. We've got to develop it. Size to load is probably co-op's biggest issue. If you want to size your system to provide your own electricity, again, this is America. Like, if you want to provide your own electricity with solar and a battery, do that. My job is to provide electricity, affordable, reliable, and safe electricity to the 68,000 people who are depending on us to do that. And rooftop solar owners of solar systems have no obligation to do that, no reason that they're going to operate that same solar system the next day. And so a resource that's not dependable, that's not reliable, and certainly is not affordable, is not one that we want to count on to provide electricity to the rest of our membership. And so we have found solutions. That member that I mentioned, he's now developing these large arrays, and we have contracts with him that are beneficial to him financially and really good for our members. So those solutions are coming along. Battery storage, you know, we are part of probably the most progressive G&T in the state and one of the most progressive in the country when it comes to research on battery storage. They have projects that they're developing. But I'll just say I don't think that stuff's quite ready for Main Street yet from a financial perspective.
Representative Kraft?
Or to the other testifier.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just to kind of, there was a shout out to California. I just want to clarify. So California reached about 25% penetration. So, you know, 25 times where we're at today in Minnesota. And the change was not to eliminate net metering. It was to modify net metering so that it essentially encouraged battery storage more aggressively, right? And the challenge they found in that transition was that the battery storage market was really just not
mature enough to accelerate in the way that they need it. And so I think that, you know, that's a model that's sort of evolving, and it's an area where I absolutely think that, you know, Minnesota should be one of the states that, you know, works more on battery storage, and we need to find a way to try to pilot this and improve integration with that into these DER systems. You know, it's not a silver bullet, but it is a key part of the future for these projects. You know, and so I think that's an important part of the picture.
And I'm just, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to add to that, too.
Representative Baker.
Because, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, recent articles that I read, too, and back to the California discussion that we saw, if you remember, members, at the first one of our meetings this year, Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff presented our committee this update that the net reading costs in California were had cost increases just related to net metering around 2.5 cents a kilowatt. And that was over a five-year period of time. As a driver of the increases in California's electric prices, net metering was only second to the billions of dollars that they had in damage in California wildfires. So it was their largest driver of their rate increases at that point. What I'm trying to get us to get to is let's not wait that long because of the percentage of that at the time was much larger. The longer we wait, the higher the rates are going to have to go before we actually do make some changes. So the sooner we do this, when it is low percentage on the grid, I think it's the right time to do this. So I just, we saw that earlier from Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff. I want to bring that out because that's why California also drove to change this.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker and our testifiers. This is such an interesting debate, and I really want to give credit to you, Representative Baker, and all the work that you've done with everyone to kind of bring us this discussion today, because it's a very unique topic, right? I've been sitting here listening. I mean, it's the numbers, the percentages, it's a lot, right? And fully understanding how we can get to a place that makes sense for everybody. I think the question that I just want to ask, and it's maybe just a blunt yes or no question, which are hard around here, but when we talk about net metering, when we talk about solar providers and companies that are installing solar, the question I have, is net metering part of the business model for how you sell and market solar to potential buyers and people that want to install it in the state of Minnesota?
When you say
Mr. Dooley?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Igo. So the ability to self-supply your own power is the foundation of the projects that we do. This sort of, you know, concept of, hey, you know, do you want to become a miniature power producer and sell power at 13 cents and make a profit from it, that doesn't enter the conversation. That's really not part of the conversation with folks that we work with doing these projects. You know, and respectfully to, you know, our industry, right? I mean, if that's how you're looking to generate profit, there's other places you could invest your dollars, be a higher yield than building a solar array that's too big, you know? You know, but we do encounter folks from time to time that say, okay, I'm buying an EV next year, so I'm going to build it a little bigger than I need to today because I want to have capacity to feed that. So you know, that does come into play. But this concept of sort of the profiteering being the motive is not, you know, part of the market, in my opinion.
Representative Igo, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that response, because I think that's kind of one of the big things we want to make sure and address and vet out there, right, is that that isn't the case. Because there's a lot of factors that go into investments, and I just don't think it matters if what side of the issue you're on us. We just don't want to see net metering being used as a tool to marketeer solar expansion, right? And I think it is a question of have and have not, because solar, even though it is affordable, is expensive. And I just don't think anyone wants to see consumers being told that this provision is what's making their systems have an ROI. And that's probably my biggest concern that I see through my district in greater Minnesota. So I just kind of wanted to ask that. And again, thank you for all the work on this. I'm learning a lot and taking notes here, but that was just one that came to my head as we were talking through all this. So thank you.
Just a reminder, we have about 11 minutes left. And if we need to, we can get the room later on to continue this conversation. I'm not going to do that. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we have two more testifiers.
We have two testifiers.
Yeah.
Could we just,
if we
got just a hidgen of time, you mind if we,
yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to have the other testifiers come forward so we can make sure we hear from
them. Sounds
good. Sounds
good.
And then we can sort of, I think,
We'll catch you.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson and Murphy, you're noted that you have a question. If we can get to you, we absolutely will. All right. O'Keefe? Or 10 p.m. potentially, so whenever the room opens up. All right. If you want to introduce yourself to the committee.
Sure.
Hi, everybody. Hello, Chair Swedzinski and committee members. My name is Patty O'Keefe. I'm the Midwest Regional Director with Vote Solar. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I want to focus my comments, kind of drill in to this specific topic about penetration of solar in Minnesota's cooperative and municipal territories. And you've heard a little bit about that today, but I'm just going to go a little bit deeper on that. So, according to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission's Distributed Energy Resources in Minnesota report, solar penetration remains extremely limited across the state. In almost all utility service territories, distributed energy resources make up less than 1% of customers. Out of the 167 utilities in Minnesota, which is 120 municipal utilities, 44 electric cooperatives, and 3 investor-owned utilities, only 17 have more than 1% of DER penetration. And as Griffin noted, that the highest reported level is just 3.2%. So the majority of Minnesota's co-ops and munis have less than 1% of solar penetration today. And net metering only applies to systems that are less than 40 kilowatts. So within that 1%, we're only talking about the systems that are 40 kilowatts or smaller. For the systems that are 40 kilowatts or smaller, many of the systems are simply offsetting the customer's own electricity use over the course of the year, meaning they're not regularly exporting excess power back to the grid. So when you take all of that together, less than 1% of overall penetration, only a subset of systems over 40 kilowatts, and many of those are primarily offsetting their own load. The number of customers who would actually receive net metering payments is just a fraction of utility members. So much of the conversation is focused on the potential burdens from net metering, but what has not been part of the discussion as centrally is the benefits that distributed solar provides to the grid, the avoided costs, the reduced strain on transmission structure, deferral or just avoidance of expensive grid investments, and the efficiency of providing electricity close to where it is used. So those avoided costs are real and create real value for co-op members and muni members and IOU members. So to this day, we still haven't seen that kind of robust cost-benefit analysis that kind of takes into account all of those pieces. And since this, you know, legislation, this law is about 40 years old with a track record like for that long, I think like we really at the very least need to see what those numbers are if we're talking about rewriting something, you know, as significant as our net metering law. So thank you again for the opportunity.
Any questions? All right, Bobby King. Do you want to introduce yourself to the committee?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Swedzinski. My name is Bobby King. I'm the Minnesota State Director for Solar United Neighbors. Fortunately, most of what I wanted to say has already been said, so I'll try to add a little bit. We work to help folks go solar, farmers, small businesses, and homeowners around the state. And I wanted to say, and I saw Minnesota Farmers Union submitted a nice letter in support of net metering. And particularly for farmers, I think net metering is a key tool because it's a tough time always to be a farmer, especially now. The only way really to increase profits is to become more efficient and lower your input costs. So going solar, you know, it isn't cheap. It's a big upfront investment. And you can over time lower your energy costs, but more as importantly, what you do is you lock in a price so you can plan. And as a business person, that's invaluable. As a previous testifier just said, this is about relatively small scale solar, 40 kilowatts and below. The state saw a benefit of promoting on-site, customer-owned, distributed solar. And I want to say, and for rural communities that don't have access to the incentives provided by Xcel, our current policy is key, I think, to continuing to see solar be an opportunity for rural Minnesotans. I think at the size of the systems we're talking about, at the penetration we're talking about, there it would be hard, I think, to demonstrate there's any kind of cost shift at all. And lastly, I want to talk about who these folks are. These are long-time rural residents going solar. If you're going solar in the community, in your house, you're going to want to be there for at least 10, 15, 25 years. These are third, fourth generation farmers. They would never do it if they believed their going solar harmed any of their other ratepayers. Now, there's a lot of discussion there to decide what that's the case, but people's motive is about maintaining their ability to control their energy costs to stay in the rural community that they love and have been a part of for decades. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, if you could just specify who you're asking the question to, that would help you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I mainly just have a comment and a response to the question that Representative Igo posed. I was surprised at the answer given that the attraction or the ability to be able to sell back at full retail wasn't part of a you know, a sales pitch or a sales talk, that it wasn't really, you know, that big a deal in terms of talking about going rooftop solar or not. And if that's the case, what are we here for? I mean, if it's not that big a deal, the net metering piece, if it's not part of the selling process to people, it can't be that big a deal. So again, I just have to go back to, if the wholesale cost is 4 cents kilowatt hour, business-wise, that's what you should pay to purchase electricity from any source, I think. And so that's my comment, that again, that response surprised me.
Okay. Sounds good. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the same level. So, Mr. Dooling, you said that there's absolutely no interest in any talk of an ROI. You talk about an ROI when you explain the program to people?
Mr. Dooling?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Murphy, I think it is, right? So to be clear, I mean, the concept is you can reduce your costs, as Bobby described, by producing your own energy, right? Similar to, you know, you can produce your own fruit or, you know, produce on your property and not have to go to the grocery store. The concept I was referring to is this idea that folks are being motivated to put in solar purely so that they can generate a bunch of extra power and sell it, you know, to the utility for a profit. That's not why people are doing this. And I don't think that shows up in the data when we look at the way that these systems are sized. In our business, that's not part of the conversation when we're talking to folks. You know, I don't have customers saying, you know, build me the biggest system you can so I can, you know, make some money on this thing. That's just not part of the rationale.
Mr. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Mr. Dooling, do you ever talk to people about the length of time to repay their part of the project? I mean, how long it takes? Do you ever talk about how long it takes?
Mr. Dooling.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Murphy. We do look at that. We look at, you know, what are you paying for power? How much can you produce power from your solar system for? You know, what does that look like over time? Certainly. And, you know, part of that equation is also looking at, you know, their eligibility for federal investment tax credits, their eligibility for, you know, depreciating the system. There are some utilities that have local incentives. Xcel has solar rewards. Steel Waseca Cooperative has, I think they call it Solar Sense. There's different, you know, types of programs. So that's all kind of part of that picture when it comes to looking at how will you, you know, receive, you know, benefit from this system over time. But the concept of, you know, you're going to sell, you know, your utility a bunch of power, you know, at the end of the year, it's really not the driving factor.
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Also, a follow-up to that. So I had an estimate for a rooftop solar, and it was absolutely a business opportunity. The business opportunity included an ROI. It said this, you'll pay for your rooftop solar in 8 years. The reason they could say it was 8 years because they told me what my benefit was on that retail power I was selling. It's absolutely a return on investment. It's absolutely a business opportunity. This is a business opportunity that's paid for by their neighbors. That's the problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, sounds great. It seems like
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Johns.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. Just comment on the what we're talking about around here, which is size to load. I think electric cooperatives, I can't speak for all of them, but I would imagine that
most of them, if I were to walk out of this room with a size to load deal, everything else is good. If we can trade kilowatt hour for kilowatt hour, people can produce their own electricity on a per kilowatt hour basis, we're good.
No issue.
I think we heard it here first that we have some real room here from the testifiers. All right, Representative Buck.
Madam Ayala, thank you, Chair. First question, I guess, would be to the companies. Do you have any tribal representation on your boards? And if so, what would the percentage approximately be?
Mr. Dooling?
No, ma'am. I'm the only owner of our company, so we do not have any other participants. Thank you.
Mr. O'Grady?
All of you. Any of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buck, we did have one tribal member, Robert Blake, who owns Solar Bear. He recently phased off the board, though, so we don't have one currently of our 15 board members.
Mr. Johns.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't have any elected members on our board from the tribe. However, if you were here Tuesday, I mentioned in my testimony on the tribal issues, we have a space on our member resource council for the tribe, and we actually developed a 3-megawatt solar array, not behind the meter, so utility scale product that has just been fantastic for them and fantastic for the cooperative.
Thank you.
That's good. Representative Buck. We got about a minute-ish.
Okay, I can get this through. And this isn't a question for the for all of you, so I'm sorry about that. But I believe I heard that co-ops are independent elected bodies who report to their memberships or their members who are the ones that elect them, and that we shouldn't be telling them what to do. So if that's the case, then why did we vote down the tribal energy sovereignty bill brought by Peji Huta ZZ this week? And I don't know if that's something any of us want to answer or what, but.
Any questions to the testifiers?
No.
Okay. All right, any other questions? All right, well, thank you all for coming. Members, the next meeting is Tuesday, March 17th, and Chair Aiken will have the gavel. See you in other business before us. This meeting is adjourned.